been asked as to what Jack Parsons story when he died. Well, what it came down to was this. I was privileged to see the test block, the original test block in the Arroyo Seco Norte in the Rose Bowl there in Pasadena on a particular afternoon, and it was 38, 39, or something like that. And he was a genius in chemistry at Caltech, and he was developing rocket fuel. But by the time he died, he'd gone through the fiasco with Ron Hubbard. And he decided to split for Mexico. Why, I don't know exactly. But he's going to set up some kind of explosive plant down there. I don't know whether it was a tax write-off or whatever it was that made him want to go to Mexico. But anyway, that's what he decided to do. He was still married to Candy. In the process of transferring his laboratory from the garage where it had been stored to the trailer where he was going to drive it to Mexico, he dropped a can of potassium
mercury
fulminate, right, and it blew him apart. And the question was this intentional or not intentional?
Is it true that his last words were, "I can't go yet"? Too much work left to do.
That's what Jane Wilson.
Okay.
Well, I guess
he
good luck.
That's why we debated it. He wanted for years. Was this intentional or non-intentional? And the ultimate conclusion, more or less, was a fitting point, of course, who was talking to was to me.
But
anyway.
Didn't he like to use
mescaline? We don't know whether he had mescaline. We do know that he did have pump.
But sometimes your estrogen can have a grip on something, you know, physical, like it sucks away.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We don't know whether he had access to meth. We do know he had access to pot because some of the people around 1003 Orange Grove said that they'd seen Mr. Connicat fall by and drop off, you know, this, that. And once in a while, Parsons would get really hooked up in the morning and call into the jet prop lab at Caltech, you know, and said that he was not feeling well. And sit around being stoned all day writing poetry.
Did he have any physical children that he left behind?
Not to the best of my knowledge. None. I don't think.
What exact date did he die?
Okay. Let's see. Jack Parsons is dead. Nobody bothered to write to me and tell me. Anyway, I was in the Army. I was in Korea. I'd been in Korea for almost a year. I was up on the Eastern Front there in Tinsport. And one day I had to go to the local lavatory, which happened to be a shack, of course, with three holes cut in a piece of board. And the cold Korean air blowing up the crack of your ass. I picked up this magazine called People Today, August 13, 1952. And it had this the filler section. Had to do with the death of Jack Parsons of the L.A. Lust Cult. And you see now, that's the exact date. It doesn't give the exact date. Mary mentioned stuff and then he got it. It was off.
What's the date on the
page? Well, this is August 13, '52. So obviously it had to happen before
then. So then you find out that your best friend is dead just on accident.
Well, it was for me anyway.
A cold shot.
Well, moving on right along. Okay. Now, had you joined the order by this time? Oh, I mean, wait. Let me digress. We were going to digress back to you had met Parsons, and he was corresponding with Crowley and so forth at this time. How about you? When did you either join the order or start to correspond with Crowley?
You were wrong. Parsons was not corresponding with Crowley. This brings up something which might as well go on the record, and that is this. that has to do with hierarchy in the order. For example, a lot of people think that I'm much too stringent in some of my regulations. Truth of the matter is, I'm extremely liberal. Because in those days, nobody knew Schroeder's address. Nobody knew Carl Gerber's address. They taught in an ancient Masonic tradition that the higher degrees are out of your reach. And you didn't want to communicate with them. They communicate with you. They want you, but you don't communicate with them. And so therefore, nobody knew either Gerber's address. It was quite a while before people discovered Gerber's address, and eventually Schroeder's address. So as a matter of fact, it probably wasn't until I got to England.
It's like being a secret chief then.
In those days, it was, you know, sort of like that. Okay, it's my house.
That would be a good thing, I'm saying, certain.
In certain ways, that's very right. I'm sure it was the second part of the question.
When did you join the order?
Okay, fine. I joined the order, and I would sing this off in 1939. The reason I can't be exactly sure, of course, is due to what was the war and everything else. I've also taken papers. But in any case, point is, it had to be about 39 because I was in the Army with February of 41. I didn't get the best in until September 37. So therefore, and what happened was this, that after having gotten acquainted with Parsons at this party in Hollywood for the California Rocket Society, I still have four issues of the American Rocket Society magazine from that time, which we were granted because of our associate membership. I became, shall we say, well established there, like on weekends. It was my habit to hang out there at Harris Drive there, fast food, that place. And it was a nice company place. And I had some beautiful memories of it. For example, one night, we had a habit in those days which you might find at least nostalgic, thank you, at least nostalgic. See, in those days we weren't into plastic. 33 and a half inches. We had those old 78, thank you for sending. Vinyl, heavy as hell, right? And they were also vulnerable. So that, for example, in other words, they were easy to chip or wear out. So we had the leaders in technology at the time, and that was cactus needles. And cactus needles, that's right. And you had a little thing that was sort of like pencil sharpener, only it was for, it was very small. That's it. You put these cactus needles in this pencil sharpener, and you bang down the cactus needles.
That's cute.
It was cute. Yeah, that's something right out of the 1930s, something you would never think of.
No.
But it's true, right? So if you're doing a film, for example, and you had that scenario in it, you will go ahead, because who ever heard of cactus needles, right?
Yeah, really. That's funny. Yeah. It was only back about 1964 or 5 that they invented a needle that would play either stereo or mono records. And the man that invented just a simple little device, so people didn't have to have two cartridges, made a fortune, just off all percentage you got on the copyright or however you get on patent.
I'm talking about needles.
And this we're waiting. Okay, so you love being these afternoons you spend at Jack Parsons' house, and you were going to discuss how you got into the order then, or started reading about Crowley.
Okay, did we get the part about the cactus needles on the tape?
Yes, we got that.
Got that, okay, fine.
Yeah.
All right, fine. So one day, Jack Parsons says to me, "Ray, the guy over in Hollywood, I think you'd like to meet." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Yeah, that's why don't we go in." So the next time, they had a meeting on the weekend over there at the Boulevard, where Augusty Lodge was, and there's Wilford Smith doing the priest, and Regina Call. Now, Wilford Smith was a little shrimp of a guy, and Regina Call was a big square gal from Texas, built sort of like a rock. And that night, Luke Carroll was doing the Deacon Trip. Luke Carroll, he was a sometimes good actor in Hollywood. So was sometimes Gene Wolfe, Gene Wolfe to do the Deacon Trip. And that's when I discovered I was a fellow of mine. It was sort of funny. It came down like this. Not that it was a long off. It was we're standing there, and they, we're upstairs. Regina has welcomed us. She was a teacher of court voice at UCLA campus in the east. And so anyway, she welcomed us with her sweetest smile and so forth. I understand from people who lived in the house that she could be a real virago when she wanted it. But in any case, it was a sweet smile and she welcomed us. And some guy, how about shutting the door? Some guy played like NBC's something cathedral on the piano. And I'm sitting here in this booth with my two girlfriends sitting across from me. One of them is Foxy and one of them is Tommy. They're dressed identically alike. Foxy is a big buxom blonde chick that would later be my wife. Tommy is a small short chick, and she's also has that beautiful skin that's going to wrinkle, you know, at a very early age. But meantime, it's very beautiful, you know, and really sexy type, you know. And they're both dressed identical. I think you should go in a movie scenario or something. It was like this. They were roommates, and they had these red jumpers over white blouses, if you didn't get the picture right. Mm-hmm. And they were sitting around like twin dolls, as it were, more like one stay and one small. And Regina, and here's this, little booth over here, and here's the front room, and Regina's standing here on the stairs here, where she's at the living room, and then of course up there, is the second floor, right? And then up there is, of course, second floor. And up there in the, not the balcony, but the, under the eaves, there's this, what they call the gable. And that's where the altar is. And they got something. So I got acquainted with these people. And like one night, how I got to be, how I became a Solomon. Anyway. One night, now that that temple was big enough so that you could have people on both sides of the altar, right? And of course, we don't have the temple here in the current temple, but we got what we got. But it was. Now, we did not divide up the men and say the men stand here and the women stand there. This is sort of like how, this is sort of the way it came down. It's not right there. Anyway, we come down to the college. To the point where, Sap and World Act, Wonder Tree, we're all speaking together. And I look around, see the friendly man on my right and my left. And realize, these are the people I came down to meet. These are the people I came down to find. And that's when I became a Solomon.
That's how I felt when I came down to order here.
Now, anyway, to pick up on the Jack Parsons narrative. So, a few months later, it was agreed that there'd be an initiation at Gogarty Lodge in Little Boulevard in Hollywood. And for reasons that are still a mystery to me, but nobody ever bothered to explain it to me, it seems that in those days they had developed, they had so, shall we say, edited the Minerval and First Degree Initiation trips. We did it both in one night, which is why when I met Crowley of the First Degree, whether it's a gentleman or not, I don't know, but damn sure knows, damn sure to me, because it worked, and as far as I could tell, they did a lot of work, and, you know. But even to this day, I remember some of the scenes from it, you know. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, how I would reconstruct it, I really wouldn't know. It's all planned. I mean, it takes a lot of thinking to reconstruct something like that. It would have been earlier version of it. Mm-hmm. So I went through that. And Jack Parsons must have paid my dues, if anybody fucking dues, because I got it. I don't know if he's the one that expected this. All I know is that I'm this year. And I got my little, practice, which I promptly lost in the war. meant then that when I got to England, I was the first to be able to go. I don't know what that makes any difference or not, but otherwise, I wouldn't have even known if Crowley was in England, for God's sake, because I hadn't been there yet, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I offloaded a troop ship at Greenwich, Scotland, on the River Clyde, on October 18th, my birthday, 1943. Went through an incredible amount of processing and a considerable amount of time in Liverpool, and was able to score a jeep and trailer on October 31, 1943. Went bearing down through Bath, from Liverpool through Bath, east through Salisbury Plain, through past Salisbury Cathedral, up south at Stonehenge. Fantastic scene, I can't imagine if Trinity wasn't there. There was nobody there. Nobody was there. The whole goddamn thing was just empty, you know. There was a solid cloud of, rolling east about 30 feet off the ground, and it was solid red gray, you know, about 30 miles an hour going like that. It was like being enclosed with some fantastic primordial energy in the universe, you know. And rolled on in to London, found 90 Jersey Street, and they got to throw it.
And how, you were saying that usually no one had his address back in the States. How were you able to have his address?
As a matter of fact, come to think of it, I would suppose that I got it from Carl Germer in New York City. On my way over, I stopped in New York City to meet Carl Germer, and how I got Germer's address, I'm not sure, probably from Robert Smith. But the way it worked in those days was you didn't really know of the higher degrees. If you recall, I said that the week when I thought the knights are invisible and nobody knows who the OHO is. I mean, nobody on the outside world or world knows who the OHO shouldn't, because that's the inner order of business, you see. Mm-hmm. And so, I'll tell you a story which might be very illustrative of this, because some of you have wondered occasionally about some of the strange practices you run into. Okay, now, once upon a time, there's a very nice guy, his name was Dr. Montenegro. He was a Chicano, and he was a practitioner of a certain medical art which probably wouldn't be recognized by the American Medical Association. That's right, every native culture has its earth. And anyway, we call him Brother Monty. Okay, fine. Now, Brother Monty was an extremely knowledgeable person, but he always seemed to come along at the wrong time. Every time he did something, it seemed like it was at the wrong time to do it. And so that no matter what happened, for example, now Dr. Montenegro, our Brother Monty, as we call him, had grown up as a stout Roman Catholic in Mexico, been an altar boy and so forth, devoted to a church, I guess, that became a high-level basin, and so forth and so forth. Now, there is a name that runs around the Hellenic history of South America. It is the Krum Heller. It's spelled Krum-Heller. And he is obviously of German descent, that name. And yet, we don't know exactly what he was up to. But we do know that every time I've run across anybody who has been initiated in South America in the Hellenic tradition, the name Krum Heller always crops up. So anyway, in the ordinary course of events, Dr. Montenegro, who was a student of Krum Heller's, and had taken certain degrees and so forth from Krum Heller, found Carl Germer's address. He didn't even know Crowley's address, but at least he found Germer's address. And he said to Krum Heller then, he said, "Well, why didn't you tell me this?" And Krum Heller said a lot of things to him, the substance of which was, "Who in the hell are you to ask?" Mm-hmm. Now, this is the ancient Masonic tradition. In initiate orders, there are spirits and there are interiors. If your spirit tells you to do something, then if you don't do it, you're not in the initiate order. Mm-hmm. It's very simple, really. Who in the hell are you to ask? And that's what it comes down to, this.
Mm-hmm.
sort of thing. In other words, at certain level, you either are there or you are not. As I truly explained in Michigan Theory and Practice on Bookshop, you join an initiate order, take the most fantastic oath, or discover at the end that you're stuck with a bunch of, like idiots or whatever. How do you explain that? He said, in terms of karma.
Yeah.
And that's the way what we're all up against here. How was it that Brother Monty was really a very nice guy? He just happened to come along at all the wrong time. And that's one thing we've got to watch too in terms of our sense of time. Okay, what's the next topic?
Okay, did you get along with Germer when you met him?
In the early days, the 40s, I did. I got along with him very well. I met him the first time when I was on my way to Europe on a troop ship in World War II. When we split from New York Harbor, that would be in October of 43, and I stopped off and I met Carl and Sasha in their apartment there in New York City, and we got along very well. They took me out to a Russian restaurant where I had abortion, which I thought was far out, you know, and so well, I got along with them very well, and got along very well with me.
How old were they at that time about?
I have no idea. They were from the World War I generation. I mean, Carl was, and certainly so was Sasha. They were, I don't know, maybe 20 years younger than I was. And the World War I generation, World War II generation, 20 years. But I would say they're in the 40s. So, going under 50s, maybe.
And, all right, so then you sailed across, and you said that you got a Jeep, was it, and so forth, and took off to find Crowley after you'd gotten to England and disembarked after a hectic day on your birthday.
Yeah, well, that was So we shipped us south of Stone in England, and that was for processing. And then I was shipped to Liverpool. And I spent a couple of weeks bumming around Liverpool, doing this and doing that, you know. And then finally I got orders that would ship me over to East Anglia. But in the meantime, I had a chance to get into London. So I grabbed a Jeep and trailer through my old trunk locker. The old trunk locker is over there in the office right now, you know. The trailer, you know, the rest of my duffel. And I headed down south through Bath and the old Roman city of Bath, left then. All I ever saw was a very cathedral with a spire because it's down the gullet. You see the spire coming across the cathedral. And then you swoop down like that, swoop up like that, you know, up on the plane again. And then there was Stonehenge, like I was saying. And then I got into London that day. They make Crowley. I don't know whether you can like this thing or not.
No thanks. I stayed. I can't take it when I just eat.
And that's the first time I met. Yeah, right.
We were speaking one time, and you said that to meet Crowley, you could only see in him according to what abilities you had in yourself, and therefore.
Well, the way I put it was this: I said what I actually said was, somebody asked me once what sight in Crowley. I said, well, if he could meet you at any level, you were capable of meeting him. Unfortunately, I was just a big dumb kid from Oklahoma, and I had to think of questions to ask him. Really, literally, you know, I'm pretty dumb, you know, and. I mean, I don't have an IQ of 110, you know, and I really had to think of things that, somebody like you maybe would just know what that is, but what level could you meet a guy like that? Christ, you could meet him at any level, because he could occupy any space you could possibly imagine. My way of meeting him was, one way, subconscious, another way, very conscious. The subconscious part was a soldier trip. Now, Alistair Crowley admired courage. That's all. Why did he become a mountain climber? Because he wanted to assert his courage, manhood, whatever you want to call it, spirit of aspiration that would go out and climb mountains. Remember, they didn't have jet planes in those days, and they didn't have this, they didn't have that. that amount of time, right? And so that also in his poetry, he would exemplify everything. And so because of the times and so forth, his records, however, were maintained in like in terms of literature, in terms of poetry, and his writings, his time, and of course for us, the fact he brought down the book of law, which of course was a prophet. Now, on the other hand, now knowing him was at the one time a pleasure, at the same time a paradox. After all, we are but human. And as I said, I did a big dumb kid from Oklahoma. So anyway, I hope happened that by chance I've gotten into OCS and wound up a first lieutenant for reasons beyond comprehension. Maybe but the intention of the secret chiefs, but this is yet to be proven. But in any case, so I'm meeting Alistair Crowley there at 19 German Street in London when I'm doing the war. And one evening, he goes out to make tea in the kitchen. And while he's out, that was the evening, I went over to the library over under the window and discovered that book of all of Native Squares, a Enochian tablet chart, carrying all the charts of the moon, right? And actually, I've been tablet chart with Enochian. And on another evening, I looked down to the right on this turntable here, from right of the chair that I was sitting in where I was playing chess with Crowley, and here's this book. Right? Or no? Oh, those are obviously Crowley's.
Yes, Crowley's
paid,
and what's the title of the
book? It is Second Books of the East, a very historical scholar, and this is the fun part. The Second Books of China, Texts of Confucianism, Wooden Leg.
Wooden Leg.
He had comments like that throughout, like stupid. But the point is that this is the basis on which he was generating his own teaching. Mm.
They're very strange paintings that he painted.
I know.
On the cover.
That's the lesson. The object of the symposium this evening is this. I pick it up. I was looking at it like this. Obviously very clear. Here's a nature Himalayan sage, right? Which probably tells the Crowley. And then I flipped it over like this. And I couldn't quite make it out. It's just a little too dark. And in the meantime, he comes into the kitchen with a tea and, a thing in his hand, and brightens up and says, "What do you think of it?" And looking at it, I couldn't make it. I said something like, "Not much." Whereupon he stood up and like this, wagged his finger at me to explain to me that I was ignoramus, who wouldn't understand a good penny if I saw one.
It's a half up on a cliff, isn't it?
Well, that's what I thought it was. Yeah, but I was trying to figure out the significance of it. I guess I was wrong.
What is it?
It's the house of a cliff, and the Himalayas, like you said. But you see, I didn't have time to get that trip together before he came back in the room. Still trying to figure out what the fuck it was.
The paint has turned much darker, I'm sure, though, than when he
probably
painted.
Much darker than it was in the first painting, I'm sure. But it's just priceless because it's got all those comments, about stupid, or whatever the case may be. Well, anyway, it wasn't the first meeting, but anyway, that was during the times I would meet him at 19 German Street in London. Now, he only got really pissed with me twice. That was one time. And the other time was he had actually been playing chess and taking band-aids, putting drinks, and so forth, and rapping for quite a while. He went out to the kitchen to make tea, and while I was out, of course, I was looking around his library. And there's a double row of books over here under the window. And in it, there was this square black volume that didn't have any printing on the spine, which is something somewhat unusual. So I picked it up for some compulsive reason, and it was sort of like Snow White from the Wicked Witch with the poison apple trip. I knew I had to, you know, it was sort of a compulsive trip. I had to have that piece of book, and I picked it up and walked over to the chair. Sit down, here's a chess table, here's a chair that Curly would be sitting in 2 minutes. Came back in the kitchen, I cracked the book. Only it wasn't a book in any conventional sense. What it was a set of Enochian squares, I'm sorry, Obermann squares, which I discovered later were charged with Enochian angels. And what God's name they were charged for, I don't know. But anyway, Crowley would be a mass magician. But anyway, like I said about the compulsive trip, I had opened it, and I was looking at it, and the funny thing about it was that the letters were so big. They were really very big. And they looked very perfect, as if they had been printed. But I couldn't imagine anybody who had type that big. And so there, what I was thinking was, golly, these things must have been painted on there. No wonder. And I'm just about ready to touch the, you know, the first letter here, this finger here, to see if it had been painted rather than printed. When Crowley came out of the kitchen, saw me, and yelled, literally, don't do that! And I stopped, you know, and I was very surprised. And he said to me, much more quietly, you had no idea what forces you could ever unleash. Now, that's what I mean about being around on control. On the one hand, it was a blessing. On the other hand, you sometimes wonder. Like, for example, his criticism on our poetry. For example, we don't have to put this on tape because Katie has it available. When I was in Normandy, I wrote a poem, Normandy. And
why don't we put it right in here?
I don't know. For one thing, do I have it?
So right in here, we're going to type in Normandy in June.
Okay, then by the time we got to chart, which is spelled C-H-A-R-T-R-E-S, it's pronounced chart by the French, I got down off the adrenal high of the invasion, and I wrote a poem called The Cynic, which was, like sort of a real downer trip. But Cody liked it. He thought it was brought in some real insight, and so on. Then in the Battle of Northern France in September, so forth. The point about this, all that is that this is a moving war. We were moving fast, and so I could write short segments of poetry about it. When we get to Korea, it was different, because that was a static war. And knowing Crowley could be a very exasperating experience. On the one hand, you really loved him. On the other hand, you didn't exactly know what he was going to say next. With me, for example, like I would send him the samples of my poetry, and he would write back, and he'd accept one that I felt was not really worthy of consideration, and reject one that I really liked, and so forth. So in that sense, but he would give you reasons, and these reasons were invaluable. So in that sense, it didn't really matter whether or not your little ego was bruised. The point is, that you're being given instruction by probably the greatest master of the English language in the 20th century. The first time I saw Alistair Crowley was October 31, 1943, at least I know this for sure, because they gave me a copy of one of his poems about his Russian trip, and the date is there, and his signature is there, welcoming me to the German Street. One of the, as I said, Nancy German Street is just off the daily surface. But one of the things that sticks in my mind that shows the human side of Alistair Crowley is it was around Christmas of 1943, of course, and actually it was cold and somewhat snowy. But anyway, typical English winter, right? And we're sitting there one afternoon. I'd gotten into town early and playing chess, smoking pretty. And so forth, and rapping. And there's this raucous noise at the door, And Crowley said, when he said in Crossing Chess Forbidden, I wonder what in the world that is, in some annoyance of it. And got up, walked around, went over the door. Now, wondering myself what it was, I got up and stood behind him. And said, was it? There were four English schoolboys of, you know, schoolboy size standing outside, bawling Christmas carols. And the habit in those days was that they would stand and sing in front of your door until you painted. They would not go away until you were paid. Well, this time they did, because what Crowley did, he slammed the door around the camera tree and said, to the lions of them! To the lions of them! And we went back and walked away just like that.
Oh, that's good, to the lions of them.
That's the Oscar Crowley, I think, it was like that.
Beautiful. And so then you were there, what, 2-3 days? Or?
Well, no, it wasn't like that at all. The way it worked was this. I was in the Army. I was a company commander. I was a very responsible person. I had to get this company together for the invasion. And I wound up in East Anglia, which is up north, or whatever, over the east coast of England. This company up with those B-17 bases up at Bury St. Edmunds. But once in a while, I could grab the Jeep and drive into London. It was literally driving onto the battlefield because the German bombers, you could hear them upstairs, you could see them dropping bombs, you could see the bombs flying off the ground there. And you could see them wiped out just standing around looking. And so anyway, I'm afraid that once you grab the 35. The question by Kay is how long did I see Crowley? The point is, I gather there's a time differential here. The truth of the matter is, I saw him only occasionally, and usually only for a few hours, on any particular day when I could get into London, or to the Athens after he moved up there, or, well, of course, when he moved to Hastings, which is later. Now, what would happen when it wasn't like I would see him for days on end, you know, for hours on end, something like that. What would happen would be that I'd grab the company jeep, drive into London, park it someplace, and grab some kind of public transportation, like a two the subway, and spend as many hours as I could patrol, you know, and then I was split for country again. So that's the way it was, and I met him in at 19th German Street. I don't exactly remember how many times, but it must have been at least 6 times, maybe more, but at least 6 times. And then when he moved up to the building of Aston Clinton, at least once before I hit the invasion, at least once after I had survived the invasion. And then when he moved down to Hastings and the war was over, I was able to visit the Hastings trophy. And that was decided.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how is it that he decided that he wanted you to be a representative for him when you came back to the States?
Oh, well, that was very simple in essence. We were sitting there at in his lodgings at Netherwood on the ridge there at Hastings one afternoon, rapping. And we were rapping about many things, of course. But one thing always kept coming back into the conversation. And that was the affairs of things in the States, which meant, of course, Los Angeles, which meant there ought to be a lot. And his statement of historical reference was this, quote, unquote, I may be the world's greatest magician, but I have to have some information to go on. Whereupon, young, for example, Mercury, volunteered and said, well, I know them, I thought, they know me. I know them and you know me. So when I get home, I'll take a look at the situation and write your report. And he said, fine, I designate you Sovereign Grand Inspector General of the Order. And that's how it. He didn't give me a document, he said, I did that. And you can believe me, I believe it was set in turn after you. It had more to do with the history of the order than you can believe. Because if he hadn't said that, I would have had no occasion to go back to California to find out who the this office library. Occasionally, you and I wouldn't be sitting here talking.
Okay, so he said these words to you, and then did you come directly to California from England, or what did you do next?
Well, what I did next was I flew back to France and picked up my embarkation unit, and had to wait 30 days before I could come home because the New York longshoremen were put on a strike. Mm-hmm. And came home, was flown to the West Coast, the East Coast, and beat up old EC4. And that's how I got back home. I came home in San Francisco.
And how was the order when you went to see how the order was doing and the structure and so forth?
At that time, 45, 46, there was still an Arctic Lodge. It would survive for a considerable period of time under being the Lodge Master was Roy Lessingham. And it would survive for a considerable period of time. Then, of course, in 52, as I recall, Jack Parsons was killed. And although he was maybe a little bit unstable in terms of organization, certainly had the finances to keep him going. And after that, things just went downhill steadily, and they finally sort of resolved.
Mm-hmm. And Germer, during this period of time, were you still getting along with him?
Okay, we're talking now about what, the 40s or the 50s?
52, when Parsons died. You during this period of time. Oh, wait. No, we have to back up just a little. You had come back. You checked to see how the order was doing. The Agathila, which was still going along. Now, doesn't Crowley die within a few years of this time?
47.
And this is 46. We're talking about after the war.
So what happened was this. Having sent this to Crowley at Hastings, and Crowley having designated me a Secretary General of the Order verbally, the only commission he gave me verbally, of all his other commissions he gave me in writing, anyway. So, when I came back from Europe after World War II, I stopped up in New York, and again I met Carl Germer and Sasha, and again we had a bunch of exchange. Everything was very beautiful. Later on, then I came back to California, and later on, Germer would receive three giant packing crates from England. This was the Crowley Library. It had all kinds of things in it, and in this material, he found, among other things, among many other things, he found a document that apparently Crowley had created on Chaplin when he was playing with the idea of organization. Mm-hmm. And then in this document, he had postulated the idea, he had dropped the thing MMM. So, but he had decided to incorporate the AA and the OTO under one order to be known as the Order of Lima. And he had written down the names of a number of people he thought should belong to the Order of Lima. And then Crowley being Crowley, as he got pissed with him one at a time over time, he crossed the names off, all except one, and that was Carl Germer. So when Colonel Germer found this, he realized that he didn't, by logic, need to call an election of the 90-degree OTO. All he had to do was simply point out that he was the only member of the Order of Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And so therefore, he took the de facto action of electing himself Oichō, which is basically bad news.
Yeah.
But that's taking on a karma, isn't it?
Yes. So Crowley had died at this time when the Crowley Library had arrived in Milton.
Yes. Where was that in 47? Gerber died in 62.
Okay, how far away from Gerber did you live during these years? I mean, did you see him very often or never? Or?
Depend on which years it was. In the years after War II,
he's a bishop in
No.